You're listening to edition 282 of the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2014. The Monocle Weekly in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 282 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol right here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we celebrate the radical news of Egon Schiele as we meet the curator of a major exhibition of the artist's work here in London.
Plus, we take to the North Sea with Michael Pye as he tells us how it helped give rise to the modern world. And I quit. No, not really, Andrew. The writer Matt Potter joins us in the studio to discuss his collection of great resignations.
That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Another day, another dollar, Andrew, and another busy week. It does seem they're coming thick and fast here at Midori House of late.
They are. The Forecast, which is the magazine I've been, well, kind of going on about a bit, actually. It's going to come out this week. It's a new production from the team at Monocle. It's a handy kind of book-sized guide to the world in 2015 and beyond. A very Monocle perspective on everything from the world of retail to defence to architecture to even what will happen to the former states of the USSR. But there's other news we should dwell on as well. Do you think Rob Bound's married?
I gather this
that's the thing I want to forecast.
I gather this is what's been occurring. And he's engaged in some sort of, I don't know...
He's engaged to some sort of woman, I think.
You're no longer engaged, are you, once you're officially married?
Well, this is the problem. He was going to America and he hadn't actually arranged the wedding date. He hadn't got the kind of the right to get married in City Hall, which he's doing in Miami. So we believe he's there. Haven't heard whether it happened.
He's busy. He's a hard man to pin down at the best of times.
And also, because it's the Miami Art Fair, the Basel Art Fair, is going to be straight afterwards. He's whipping his bride straight there. That's the honeymoon.
I don't want to know if Rob's whipping his bride anywhere, to be quite frank, Andrew. Yeah, Art Basel Miami Beach says that's always very exciting, actually. And we'll be doing lots of exciting radio about that. There's some exciting things on Monocle 24 to do with the forecast as well, once that hits newsstands in. Well, it's quite soon, isn't it? And there's no peace for the wicked, I gather. No sooner forecast is gone, you have to turn your sights to something else.
Then we do Alpino. And then we do the February issue before Christmas as well.
You got, what, hours to do all
that? No, that's fine. But next week I'm going to be saying hello to all our subscribers in New York, I hope. We're doing a book signing there on Tuesday for the Guide to Good Business. Then we come back and then we have another last run through Asia. We'll be in Hong Kong again for some events for our readers and also in Tokyo as well. So, yeah, busy last few weeks. And you've been having most Mondays off.
I have not been having most Mondays off, just now and again.
And you've been doing some rag rolling and things and scrunching.
Little bits here and there.
Okay.
I've got a selection of...
paint finishes.
Of rollers.
Okay.
But a sort of an extendable one, you know, for ceilings and that, the tricky corners, and then a more compact one.
Painting is always quite fun. It's the preparation that's miserable.
But I don't know. I kind of... There's something about the sort of...
Sandpaper, you don't mind?
I've got a random orbital hand sander.
Oh, now you're talking.
That's right. I'm moving up in the world, Andrew. I find it very therapeutic. I don't know something about painting.
Yeah, the painting. I just don't like the dust.
Oh, the prep work.
That's boring.
Sugar soap, whatever the stuff you have to clean everything with.
Yeah, and
that's the height of tedium.
That's why I'm not allowed to do it anymore.
Do you know what I also bought last week? 10 bags of gravel.
Oh, you're making a path?
I'm putting over some beds at the back, yeah.
Okay, very nice.
I think Andrew looks worried about
that's
me.
That's the last thing I can ask you about your DIY fear before
we might start getting complaints.
For our listeners to switch off. Talking of random grinders,
that is good.
We should call in for the news. Look ahead, because you're in the hot seat today, and with Rob away, we should call in little Danny Giacopelli.
That is one of the best things I've ever heard.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that, Danny?
I like it, actually. It's fresh. It's new. It's better than the Sopranos theme song, which has been played before.
Well, they're all different tributes.
Frank Sinatra.
They're all kind of relevant to A Boy from Long Island.
I suppose so.
With that nice Italian heritage.
Oof.
Okay. I don't want to threaten your family.
Okay. sleeping with the fishes.
Where are you going to take us?
I'll take Tom to Uruguay, because today is the general election runoff vote. Everybody's favorite guy, Jose Mujica, he can't run anymore. He's the man who lives a poor life.
The humble president, they call him, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw some Saudi prince had offered to buy, because he goes around in an old Beetle, doesn't he?
Exactly.
An old car.
His old car.
And some Saudi prince said, I'll buy it off you for a few million. That'd be a nice thing to have.
Well, he was going to turn it into charity, I think. He was going to sell it for, I don't know if it
happened. Even gives away almost all of his, sort of, the wage that he gets from his political office.
Right.
He even gives most of that away. He lives incredibly modestly.
Now, do you think it's a PR stunt, or do you think he's actually a nice guy? I hate to be cynical here.
No, I think he's probably a nice guy.
You think he's a really nice guy?
Yeah.
He's putting his money where his mouth is. Okay. Or he isn't, if you see what I mean.
Well, he can't run anymore, and there's going to be a face-off between two people who aren't him. So we'll be watching that closely.
first with all the detail, Tony Giacopelli.
Now you feel informed, don't you?
Also, today, Switzerland, we always love when they have these referendums where people can vote exactly on what they want. And today they're voting on immigration quotas and also on repatriating their gold. So for the first one, the referendum is basically to see if they want to cap immigration by 0.2% of the population, which is about 16,000 people per year.
That's quite a small number.
It is quite a small
number. But it's significant, I guess, in the gesture, politically, what that means. I'm always rather uncomfortable about that kind of thing. You get quotas, migrants. It sits uneasily with me.
Well, we've seen what happened here in the UK. They've been trying to stick to 100,000 a year, and they haven't been able to make that. So it's all well and good doing these things, but then suddenly you find your industry needs these people. And what does it mean about repatriating the gold? What's going to happen to that then?
Basically, they're trying to bring the gold back to Switzerland. It's a member of parliament has announced this initiative. Essentially, they're trying to stop all gold sales by the Swiss National Bank and require the Swiss National Bank to hold 20% of its assets in gold. The government's against the initiative.
It'll be tripling their reserves, I think. Seem to recall reading
golden immigration, Switzerland.
In a nutshell.
This thing we've been talking about, you know, is how many European nations are harking back to a time when they felt that things were safer and calmer and more reliable. Mm. Everyone's a bit nervous.
But I don't know, it just strikes me as being slightly, you know, it's not a very enlightened way to look at things, to be so, you know, dominated by, you know, looking back to, you know, oh, it was much better 50 years ago. In fact,
I've written a monologue about this very topic. If you go to the website and you can check it out.
You just promoted yourself on it.
No, I thought that was the sound of tumbleweed.
Tomorrow, Cyber Monday. And I believe here it's called Mega Monday, which quite a...
Mega Monday.
I like Cyber Monday better. Busiest shopping day of the year online, that is. And yeah, will you guys be buying anything?
I'm not a huge internet shopper. What do I buy on the internet? The odd thing, but not very many.
I do prefer, and this is not merely parroting, you know, the view here, because we put a great premium on, you know, bricks and mortar. But I like to be able to see the wares that I'm buying, you know, physically hold them, look at them.
It's funny you say that, Tom, because I just wrote a monologue about that. in fact, it was on Wednesday, I think, of last week, this very issue, so you can check that out.
I've just been doing some work in my house, and I did order some things that I'd never seen before, and actually kind of worked out well. Even bought things off Etsy. How modern is that?
Etsy. So you met the person who made it. You talked to her. Or him. Well, I say her, but it
was a her.
There are a lot of hers on Etsy.
There was a lot of her involved. It was very good. Although it did say something about the American postal system, because she popped it in the post. It was a light. She popped it in the post. And you could track how it was traveling. And I saw she'd kind of popped it in the post in deepest Florida. 2 weeks later, it got to Miami. By post. It took 2 weeks. And then I thought, great, it'll be here in another month. Another month
thing. And trap
because they're going to put it on a dinghy or something.
Well,
so what
bizarre.
Was going on with the postman?
Well, I suppose you don't want to hear about the British Curry Awards, which is also on Monday. Let's skip. Tom, I know you just saw a movie about Turner, the famous British painter.
Oh, yes, of course.
One of his masterpieces, one of the last masterpieces, in fact, from Turner in private hands, is going on sale in Sotheby's on Wednesday the 3rd. Of course, we all love Turner. How did you find the movie?
I did not think it was as good as some of the criticism. There's some good performances. I didn't feel like I learned a great deal more about Turner the man, I must say.
I prefer his sister, Paige.
Classic. You'll be reading that joke in a Christmas cracker near you.
And also, this is quite interesting, staying on the auction theme. Christie's is selling the only Nobel Prize that a living person has that's going to be sold ever. So it's Dr. Watson, who was one of the discoverers, of course, of DNA. He's selling his gold Nobel Prize to raise money for various good things. I think that's commendable.
Yeah, that's all right. I don't mind him selling it.
I mean, he's not selling it to buy a car or Ferrari or something like that. He's donating the money, so.
Yeah, I think they did quite well out of that, didn't they? Him and his colleague, Mr. Crick.
Indeed.
What, cash-wise?
In fact, we could bring it all the way back to Long Island, because I'm pretty sure they have a lab on Long Island where all kinds of genetics research is done.
Well, I think that was pretty good.
I mean, I can talk forever if you guys want me to say, but...
let's think of our listeners. And...
You probably wrote a monologue about that as well, didn't you?
I will. I'll write a monologue about how well this went today.
Very good indeed. Daniel Giacopelli, thank you very much for looking ahead at next week's news today.
Now, have you ever wondered how the successful people of history tackled the sticky subject of resignation? Or perhaps you've gazed bleary-eyed through the window and plotted your own escape from the day job? Well, if so, you may do well to turn a page in a new book to get your creative juices flowing.
The aptly titled Fuck You and Goodbye, The Dark and Hilarious History of the Resignation Letter takes a look at the bold parting shots of everyone from Mikhail Gorbachev to Che Guevara, Steve Jobs to Charlie Sheen. Exploring the exit wounds left in their wake, it shows us how they changed our world and throws a spotlight onto modern life itself. The book's author, Matt Potter, joined me in the studio a little earlier, and I asked him why this fascination with the end game.
I sound like a politician. I'll answer that question in two ways, if I may. The first one is that I had a very particular personal epiphany to do with resignations. I was one of the Auf Wiedersehen pet crew in Germany as the Berlin Wall was falling. And I remember just picking up the newspaper, the German newspapers, every morning on this building site and seeing, oh my goodness, everyone in the Communist Party has just resigned en masse. Oh my goodness, everyone in the state has just resigned en masse. They're all crawling over walls. It struck me that history could be made not by people rallying to banners and announcing initiatives and starting wars, but by people just wandering away. So I did that. It was 4 a.m, and I had a job on this building site that was to incinerate incinerate the turds left by the builders on the building site the night before with a blowtorch. And I just thought, what? There's got to be more to life. And I took inspiration from those people from the Communist Party who had resigned. And I walked up to the guy and I said, look, this is my moment. I'm doing like them, and I'm off as well in my own small way. And the foreman looked like he'd seen a ghost, and I was electrified. I thought, I felt like I'd invented the electric guitar or something. I thought, this is the power of the resignation. Only later did somebody say it was because I hadn't took off my turd burning gloves. But that stuck with me, and I began watching, especially through the collapse of the Soviet Union, when, you know, Gorbachev's resignation, Yeltsin's half-cut resignation, where he wailed and wept and everyone loved him, and then it turned out that was ghostwritten for him. And all of these things, and it struck me, yes, that history is entropy and that it's formed by the forces of sod this.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because you say in the introduction, you know, the old cliche that, you know, history is written by the winners. Is there a sense then that these stories, these moments of epiphany, are they the story of, you know, political, or are they the story of life's losers necessarily, or is that not the case?
Well, I suppose depending on the frame of reference and the terms of the game you're playing, maybe not the people who stick around to lose the game, but maybe the people who refuse to recognise the legitimacy of the game and who deny the game and who say, you know, I'm not playing this anymore. This is wrong. And that's what a resignation letter is, really. There's been a contract, there's been a set of agreements, and it's somebody challenging those agreements and using the last document that they will write in that capacity to tell you everything that's in their heart.
Now, you'll probably see here, I've got your book here, and I've got the corners turned down at various examples. I was like, oh, I want to ask Matt about that and that. Oh, and this one and this one. So I'll just delve into a few of the favourites.
In fact, this will turn into an audiobook reading.
Why not? It'll write itself. One of my favourites, and this actually goes some way to what you were just talking about, which is sort of how you unpack everything that's around you, is this extraordinary Goldman Sachs resignation. And as you said, you can sort of set out the credentials in one part, and then there's a very sort of demonstrative unpacking of this world around him. The executive, I think, is Greg Smith.
Greg Smith, absolutely.
I mean, pretty extraordinary stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and the funny thing is that when you get resignations like that, and Greg Smith's came from, as you say, from Goldman Sachs, after this tremendous kind of pressure cooker feeling, we've had the financial crisis, and you know what? There hadn't been that many resignations. You know, there'd been a few heads had rolled, but it had all been, oh, we have to keep the talent in-house and smooth. We'd had that, and the public mood was slightly electrified, and then you got this, and it turned into a lightning conductor. And, I mean, the guy was very clever in enumerating the faults of his bank in a very public way, because he, at the same time as he emailed it around, he had arranged to have it printed as the New York Times morning op-ed, just unexpurgated and full. So actually a lot of his superiors and his line managers on the way into Goldman Sachs this morning picked up a copy of his resignation letter at the newsstand and saw, I mean, it could only be called, I suppose, an act of asymmetrical economic warfare.
Now, there's quite a few notable political resignations on the years. You talk about sort of Nixon, his various resignations.
Attempts to wriggle out of it.
Down the years. Including one was like, you'll never hear from me again.
That's 10 years before.
Exactly. One that's been in the press a lot recently here in the UK. I guess, you know, it's parochial to a degree, but it's interesting because it sort of describes a lot of these dynamics is this, the Tory chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, who resigned over Plebgate, as it were, what he did or didn't say to a police officer. And your take on this is quite interesting because you mentioned having described and quoted from what Mitchell says, that it was considered, you know, pretty bog standard. Absolutely. I'm bringing bad press. You know, I can't do my job properly. But you point out actually it was slightly different than some of those others.
Your resignation, when you fix who you are in the public mind, when you resign, you state your case. That's never fixed. And Andrew Mitchell said, you know, it sounded, as you say, bog standard. It was, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But it changed because, of course, after the resignation letter was there on the public record, the facts around it changed and other things came out. And I think it changed from he would say that, wouldn't he, to he told us so. It's a strange moment. And Tony Blair's did the same thing when he stepped down from his Sedgefield constituency. His whole kind of the dying swan act was all very much, I know you don't agree with me about Iraq, but don't judge me on Iraq. Know that I was sincere. Judge me instead. Don't look at that. Look at this. Look at the Goldilocks economy. Look at the beautiful economic legacy I've left behind. And of course, that sounded great on the day. And within weeks, we were rescuing Northern Rock. By putting yourself out there too far, you can easily make yourself look like a bit of a dick.
I wonder, do you think, I mean, from all of your research and your fascination with this topic, are there historical examples, you think, that particularly contemporary politicians look to and they sort of think that's the tone I want to strike, that's the legacy I want to
show.
Does it undermine them, do you think, the fact that they are referencing back through history?
We've all got our influences, but I do think that there are certain touchstones. There are certain, well, they're canonical in the same way that a book can be canonical. You know, we all live and die, all comedians live and die in the shadow of Python, you know. And I think in the same way, all resignations, all political resignations, Andy Coulson's, Andrew Mitchell's, they all live and die in the shadow of Groucho Marx's two-line resignation. I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me. He actually telegrammed that in order to get out of a particularly sticky social situation where he wanted to get out of this horrible, horrible exclusive club, but not to be forced to give his reasons and not to be forced to talk about it all the time. So he devised, people thought it was just a crack, but he devised this sort of circular sphinx-like little riddle that you couldn't really get further into. And these days we see that with Andy Clarkson's, when the spokesman needs a spokesman, it's time for the spokesman to step back. And it's, yeah, brilliant, hurrah, bonjour, and sort of bravo l'artiste, but it's just a way to avoid having to go any further into it. Warren Buffett does the same. With this statement, I have said everything I have to say on the matter, therefore future queries will be directed back to this statement. It's Groucho Marx is canonical, and so are people like Nye Bevan when it comes to Robin Cook's resignation. You can have great fun reading them side by side and thinking, he lifted that.
And tell me about the sort of, I guess, the knots that people can sometimes tie themselves up in, particularly when you mentioned the point in the book a couple of times, you sort of, well, this is not a comparison, but next to each other, it's about Muammar Gaddafi, what you sort of trying to take language in a direction it doesn't want to go. Rebecca Brooks, you mentioned, did the similar thing. Is there sometimes a question of people who are trying to manipulate the language? Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, is it that they don't understand? Do they not have the skill? Or do they just, they're not getting checked maybe by editors?
You know, I wouldn't want to be Gaddafi's editor. You know, so I think you've made a typo here. What? Off with his head. But I think the thing to remember about resignation letters, and I say this at some point in the book, they are an attempt, often a failed attempt, to display grace under pressure. To get to the point where you are willing to resign, you are being torn in different directions. I mean, you're emotionally torn. Your words are being wrung from you. As Macmillan said, you know, what can possibly go wrong? Well, events, dear boy, events. You know, you're being forced into corners and things like that. And I think a lot of resignation letters, if you read them as an attempt to try and make the thing that they have to say be as acceptable to them as possible, and reconcile the two masters, either the public or the boss and themselves, I think then you get pretty close to it. And that's why a lot of them, as you say, seem to be falling apart. I mean, Gaddafi's was spectacular. The United States said, I need to resign. Ooh, well, I would love to resign. However, as I'm not technically a leader, I have no position to resign from. And actually, you can read it as a sort of a Michael Jackson-esque sort of deluded rant. or you can read it as sort of somebody who's trying to talk themselves out of a corner.
Matt, when you sort of read or hear or someone alerts you perhaps to sort of great resignation letters, how do you sort of place them into your personal pantheon? Do you have sort of favourites? And are the favourites the most kind of butter-clenchingly awful ones? Or are they the ones where you actually say, do you know what, that's been done really elegantly and with great grace? I mean, how do you assess what your favourites are? Is it the good or the bad?
I think it's a bit like music. In your early teens, everybody's into heavy metal or rap or something. Everybody wants the shouty ones. And then as you get a little bit older, you appreciate the tunes that you maybe didn't spot in the sort of slightly subtler pleasures. And I think with resignations, it's like that. I mean, everybody, when they start getting into it, they love the rants and, you know, epic resignation fail for a member of Starbucks or something like that, which is great because they are full of fun and you've got to love the kind of right, I'm going to let you have it with both barrels moments. But actually, I kind of like, as I say, the ones where people are trying to talk themselves out of a position at the same time. I mean, we know if you've ever resigned from a job that you don't want to do it. It's not something you want to do. And so there's, I like to see through them and see whether there's a kind of, you know, on the positive side, this is happening, and on the negative side, this is happening. If you look at those two columns, like when you're trying to make a decision, you see them in almost all resignation letters. And then, of course, there are the really specialised ones, which are the ones put out there to kill the conversation. I love them, the politicians' ones that are sort of designed to stop anyone saying anything bad about them ever again, from Jack Profumo to Andy Coulson.
That was Matt Potter, author of FU and Goodbye, the dark, moving and often hilarious history of the resignation.
Monocle Films visits a trio of women's wear designers in London, Brussels and Copenhagen, daring women to dress in a different way.
There's two different markets in a way. There's like the fashion market, which is really unappealing to me. And then there's the clothing market, which is much more appealing and making good quality products.
Women's Wear Heroes, our latest Monocle briefing film, now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Tuned in to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with Andrew Tuck and me, Tom Edwards. So now we just heard Matt Potter talking about some of the great resignations. So here, and you'll like what we've done here, Andrew. Here's Soft Cell with Say Hello, Wave Goodbye.
Standing in the door of the pink flamingo, crying in the rain. It was a kind of so-so love, and I'm gonna make sure it never happens again. You and I, it had to be the standing joke of the year. You were asleep around, lost and found, and not for me, I fear. Tried to make it work, you in a cocktail skirt and me in a suit. Well, it just wasn't me. You're used to wearing less, and now your life's a mess. So insecure, you see. I put up with all the scenes, and this is one scene that's going to be played my way. Take your red light, I can see the makeup sliding down. Hey little girl, you will always make up, so take off that unbecoming frown. What about me? Well, I'll find someone that's not going cheap in
the sails. A nice little housewife will give me a steady life and won't keep going off the rails. Take your hands off me, I don't belong to you, you see. Take a look at my face for the last time. For quite a while now, and to keep you secret has been hell. We're strangers meeting for the first time, okay? Just smile and say hello. Say hello, then wave goodbye. Say
And that was Say Hello, Wave Goodbye by Soft Cell.
The artist Egon Schiele had a short life. Born in 1890, he died in 1918. But his radical and unflinching depictions of the human figure still make an indelible mark on art today. A bold exhibition of the artist's drawings and watercolours is currently on at London's Courtauld Gallery. It's the UK's first major museum exhibition devoted to Schiele for over 20 years.
Well, the show is called Egon Schiele, The Radical Nude, and its curator is Barnaby Wright, who is the Daniel Katz Curator of 20th Century Art at the Courtauld. Barnaby joins us in the studio. Now, looking at the introduction to the exhibition and what's been written in the catalogue, it seems you've been quite concerned to try and look at this man afresh that we've all got these perceptions about and there's all these ideas about. You've tried to say, let's not think of him in the clichés of Vienna of the time, of all the things we've taken for granted. Let's look at him afresh. Why did you think that was important?
I think it's a sort of remarkable opportunity to actually see some of his work for the first time in the UK. As you said in your introduction, it's been a long time since Schiele's been shown in this country, and there are, in fact, no works by Schiele, no paintings or drawings, that is, in the UK National Collection. So the exhibition's sort of an introduction, in a sense, for many people to his art, and therefore I think it's a good time to introduce him in a fresh way, to, you know, abandon those clichés of him just as a kind of tortured genius or a kind of obsessed with sex and eroticism. That's part of his art, but it's only one part, and we wanted to show him as a more sort of fully rounded artist and his interests as being more diverse than that.
Barnaby, it's interesting. We mentioned there that, you know, it'd been some time since we'd seen an exhibition of this sort of scope. Do you think that is because there is this, for right or wrong, this slightly enduring perception of Schiele as this sort of slightly outsider figure? You mentioned these sort of proclivities. We're often rather dismissive about him because of that. Do you think that's a problem? Is it unique to this country, or is that something that you encounter wherever you sort of talk to people about Schiele and his work?
I think it's true to say that Schiller's art can be quite tough, and he's raw and kind of unflinching in his approach. And of course, that's its appeal, and particularly its kind of contemporary resonance today. But I think the UK has been pretty slow to catch up with Schiller in terms of its national collections and exhibitions. That's partly, I think, because after both the First and Second World Wars, the taste for German and Austrian art here in the UK was obviously, you know, largely non-existent. But I think it is also partly because, you know, public taste in the United Kingdom, or at least museum taste, has been much more kind of Francophile than it has kind of Germanic and Austrian more generally. And the types of unflinching work that Schiller was producing hasn't found a sort of ready audience here. So it is quite staggering, though, I think, that, you know, we're 2014 and we're talking about this exhibition as if it's a major step, which indeed it is.
So tell us about these radical news. I guess when you look at the images, there are a couple of things that strike you. One, you know, maybe there is an eroticism there, but often it's quite dark. It's quite, you know, people look quite bruised and raw, and they're not always kind of just celebrating like the beautiful form. And especially when he drew himself, when he drew male nudes, there's oddly a weird echo of what would happen after the Second World War, when you see people like skinny, skinny, skinny. It's like really, there's something a bit scary about some of the images.
Yeah, I think Schiller really looked at the kind of official art around him in Vienna and elsewhere in Europe, and said to himself that this type of ideal form that was being sort of churned out of the art academies and shown at, you know, the Vienna Academy and the Royal Academy in London, that those sorts of figure types, classicising, idealised, beautiful, that they just didn't speak to the experience of what it was to inhabit one's body in, you know, the early 20th century. And for Schiller, who was absolutely part of that kind of Viennese world of radical thinking and radical art, so the art of Gustav Klimt, the thinking of Sigmund Freud, for example, it demanded really a new type of figure, and that is often far from being beautiful and idealised. As you say, his nudes often speak to a kind of concern with the kind of pain and torment within us, with sexual desire, but not always sexual desire as joyful and celebratory, sometimes as anguished and painful as well. And I think one of the things we want to bring out in the show is just the variety of ways in which Schiller kind of addresses human experience through his nudes. There's not just one Schiller in this exhibition, I think. There's many, and that's an important part of his art.
And Barnaby, just the sort of the context that we're looking at, the sort of early part of the 20th century then, you did have thinkers, and you mentioned Freud, you had, you know, artists like Schiller looking at things in a different way, whether it was, yeah, the classic nude and putting their take on it. To sort of put the backdrop to that, was it necessary for these artists who were sort of a bit more risk-taking to kind of go out on their own, or was there a sense within the wider art community that it was a time to experiment, it was a time to push those boundaries a little?
Yeah, I think Vienna is a particularly sort of special place at this moment, because it does have a quite developed and sophisticated avant-garde art scene, and indeed intellectual and literary scene, partly through the kind of cafe culture in Vienna, so people sort of exchanging ideas from a wide range of different disciplines and backgrounds. And Gustav Klimt, who was older than Schiller, had already made some breakthroughs in the 1890s in Vienna and had established his own sort of secessionist movement. So Schiller was sort of supported to a degree by like-minded progressive artists at that time. But he soon sort of made it his business to move beyond even the kind of breakthroughs that they had made. So by the age of sort of 1920, if we're talking about 1910, 1911, he was producing figure types and nudes that were moving beyond what even the most sort of extreme edge of the avant-garde artists, people like Oskar Kokoschka in Vienna, were doing. And that marked him out quite early on.
And Barnaby, who are the men and the women who appear in these pictures?
Well, to start with, they are people close to Schiller. So he draws himself obsessively. It needs to be remembered, he's 1920, has no money to speak of, so can't afford professional models. So drawing himself is a way of getting an immediate figure. His sister, who he's very close to, he draws. Then a range of friends, including this kind of strange guy called Dominic Osen, who's a mime artist, an expressive dancer. And his dance movements really really inform a lot of the kind of figure types and poses that Sheila draws and is famous for, these very kind of angular figure types. And then he's also drawing on that kind of underbelly of Vienna at the turn of the century, that is to say the kind of street prostitutes who frequented his studio to pose for him rather than sort of standing on the cold street corners. And so they are a part of his art at that time as well.
Barnaby, this exhibition affords the opportunity to take, you know, a real sweep of history and look back. How do you chart the sort of linear movement from, you know, Sheila to his influence? We look at, say, contemporary artists now. Is it a linear process, or is it a lot more complicated and fragmented, that sort of, you know, the development of, say, the depiction of the human form?
I think it's more complicated than that. Sheila's sort of posthumous reputation, so he dies in 1918, aged just 28. It actually takes quite a long time until he's sort of celebrated as one of the great figures of the early 20th century. His sort of star kind of falls for a while and then comes back, particularly after the Second World War. There are ways, I think, of thinking about his influence in certain German expressionist artists. But, I mean, really interestingly, I think, just in the last kind of 20 years or so, there's a whole range of artists who seem to have a real debt to Sheila, and many of those are a major kind of female artists like Tracy Emin and Jenny Saville and Marlene Dumas and others, who clearly sort of reach back to Sheila's nudes in the way that they themselves kind of reappropriate the naked body for their own purposes. But then I think there's a really important kind of influence in other fields, so in design and in fashion and in dance, in music as well. I mean, one thinks of sort of album covers by David Bowie, for example, which are absolutely deliberately looking at Sheila, Iggy Pop as well. You find these strange types of sort of movement and figure and pose popping up all over the place.
And tell me, you know, when we look at these images now, I also wondered, you know, it's interesting that he was battling with many of the things that still seem to be a challenge for artists now. You know, every year there seems to be some court case where somebody's being challenged over whether their imagery is pornographic or art. And it often ends up with, you know, the police knocking on the door or taking a photograph or taking a painting away from a gallery. And this is what plagued him at the time, wasn't it? He and his friends were regularly hauled up in court for questions about the morality of what was going on in the images.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a really sort of a forerunner of those scandals in a way. In 1911, 1912, he was in fact arrested and thrown into prison and convicted for offences of public immorality. I mean, that mainly boiled down to allowing people to see his nudes in his studio, which was, you know, kind of people came in and out and saw them, and the police raided his studio and deemed that to be sort of public exposure of these nudes. And he was sentenced to 2 months in prison, which he served out. So he absolutely sort of faced the full force of the law for his art. And I think one of the things that we hope to get across in the show is that old trick of just saying, you know, Sheila took kind of prostitute nudes and turn them into great art, and therefore we don't need to worry about their subject matter, don't need to worry about questions of pornography because it's now art. I think that's something that you just need to resist doing with his work, because what's so interesting about it is the way that it always oscillates between the realms of sort of high art and the kind of realms of pornography and eroticism. And he's really frank about saying that those concerns should be part of art without kind of transmuting them into a great ideal of some kind. So I think that's what makes these works still pretty raw and sharp.
Can I just ask you a bit about that finally, Barnaby, in terms of the sort of the curatorial process? Because it always intrigues me when you talk to curators who are, you know, gathering all sorts of works, putting together, you know, a very extensive exhibition that maybe is, if not unprecedented, it's certainly unusual to see that breadth and that depth of works, certainly in this country. Does it change your experience, your sort of instinct, your feeling about, you know, the artists or about the works themselves? Were there particular works maybe that feature in the exhibition that you feel very differently about having gone through this sort of curatorial process, or is it quite easy to remain very sort of objective and look at it in a very sort of structured way?
I think it's not very easy to remain objective about it, because if you're working from sort of reproductions to start with, nothing really prepares you from then being confronted with the original work of art, which always has this kind of power in various ways about it, if it's a great work, that is. And I think with Sheila's work particularly, when you see them in reproduction, you just see them as as sort of motifs, as images in a sense, a naked form of some kind. But actually it's not until you kind of see the handling of line and of colour that a whole set of other kind of aesthetic emotions start to work on you that you just can't kind of capture in a reproduction. So that moment of seeing the real thing and then putting the real things together is extraordinary.
And does it stay as exciting as, I sense that it's still an exciting process. You know, you never become sort of jaded by the experience of constantly seeing works like this. It still has that power to kind of be inspiring that moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing like, you know, crates arriving from around the world and you sort of starting to unpack them and seeing them come together after working on a show for, you know, 3 or 4 years or something. That excitement is sort of what gets you out of bed in the morning, for sure.
That was Barnaby Wright, curator of Egon Schiele, The Radical Nude, and that exhibition is on right now at the Courtauld Gallery here in London.
Up next, we head to the North Sea.
Outspoken, in demand, and still at the top of his game, fashion designer Karl Lagerfeld talks to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, about the industry, the media, and why Berlin isn't as good as it used to be.
For me, Berlin is like a human body with an arm and a leg missing. What they did there, the Russians, made it forever something what has not the soul Berlin was famous for. I know so well the past of Berlin and the spirit of Berlin. And for me, there is not enough left from what Berlin was all about.
Karl Lagerfeld in conversation with Tyler Brulé on film, premiering now on monocle.com.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Now, we like to deal with some of the big issues here on The Weekly. So, Andrew, why don't we look next at the small matter of the development of the modern world? There's a school of thought that the crucible for its development was around the Mediterranean. But a new book by the author and historian Michael Pye has a rather different take.
In The Edge of Our World, How the North Sea Made Us Who We Are, Pye tells an extraordinary but seldom told history of money-inspired Frisians and tattooed Vikings as filthy in body as they were in mind. Tom caught up with Michael a little earlier and began by asking him whether, for centuries, we had looked in the wrong part of Europe in an attempt to understand it.
Well, I think it may be to misunderstand what actually made us modern. What made us modern was contact. It was all sorts of ideas, yes, coming north from the Mediterranean, but they crashed into systems that already existed, habits and customs in the north. And it's those compromises and those clashes and those contrasts which I think made us what we are today. And one of the problems is that we all sort of know about the Mediterranean in a funny sort of way. We remember Homer, we remember Hesiod, we know the great flotillas crossing the Mediterranean in every age. But what we don't know about it was what was happening in the north, the other essential part of turning us into what we are, modern Europeans.
And Michael, let me ask you about the North Sea then, because it's interesting that, you know, there is, by definition, I guess, a fluidity to the sea and to this transport, this means of people moving around. But there's also a fluidity too, isn't there, which you describe in the book in many cases of identity, of nationality, of nationhood, right from the start of the book throughout. It's a very fluid construct, isn't it?
Well, this book starts in an age where it did not make sense to travel by land if you could avoid it. You were going to go in a cart that didn't have springs along roads that maybe hadn't been maintained for 100 years, if they ever had been maintained, or tracks through the woods or whatever. It was simply easier to go by sea. And the effect of that is quite extraordinary if you think about it. I mean, if you were standing in a port like Ipswich on the east coast of England, and you were a merchant dealing in this, that, or the other, you're actually closer in terms of the time it takes to travel Ipswich to Bergen in Norway than you are to London. What does that do to your sense of identity and your sense of submission to political authority? And what does it do, too, about frontiers? You can't really have frontiers at sea, or at least you can't until the gunships turn up. You can't do them as you can on land, where you build a wall, you build a barrier, and it's clear who's on which side. So what you're getting is a mingling, a contact, a connection, people being able to see other things, other ways of doing things. And to me, that's the most exciting thing that comes out of the whole story of what otherwise sounds pretty unpromising, the dark ages around a grey sea.
Well, let me ask you about that specifically, because you write very elegantly about this concept of darkness and light and how, I, again, to sort of talk about misunderstanding somewhat, that, you know, the Dark Ages, I think you write it was in many ways, it was more of a dawn. That was what it was. Do you think that, again, there's a sense in which people don't really understand these kind of nuances that you write about in the book?
Well, it's been quite difficult to know about them. Because after all, most of our sources, which are on paper or vellum or parchment, are charters or their annals or their chronicles, which were written by people with a very particular point of view. And what you end up with is a history that doesn't actually contain anything about the mechanics of life or life itself. What you have is events. And if you think about it, if we had, let's say, a history of the 20th century, which was World War I, World War II, and Auschwitz, and that was it, what would we have? We'd miss out on all of the social change over 100 years, everything that happened to women's rights, gay rights, the rise of the motor car, the rise of the washing machine, changes in our ideas of what it was to be at home and to be domestic and all the rest of it. And those things also matter. We tend not to have them for the Dark Ages, just because of the nature of the sources. And what is really exciting, what's really changed in the past 20 years or so, is that there is so much new archaeological work which allows us to know about and to understand and to reconstruct to some extent the lives of people in those times. And after that you think to yourself, well, no, actually, this isn't 365 days a year rape, pillage and suffering. This is also how people lived in these particular circumstances and how it eventually became our modern world.
One of the great conduits, I guess, from these times to the modern world is the development of money. And again, you sort of, this is a bit of a recurring theme in the book, right from the beginning, where you're writing about the Frisians. It's interesting, isn't it, how that was very much, if you'll forgive the terrible pun, the sort of the currency of change.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the engine of change, let's say. We can get away from the really terrible pun. No, it was. I mean, if you think about it, by the 7th century, ordinary currency had almost disappeared in Europe. I mean, there was gold, which you have to think of it as gold bullion being shifted from one palace to one castle, you know, for the payment of taxes and that sort of thing. A very official metal and not really a currency. What happened was that the traders along the coast of the North Sea had to reinvent cash. Cash for going into a market where you weren't known, so you had to have something that was recognized to pay. Cash, in order that you could sell, it might be wool, and buy, it might be timber or grain or wine or whatever you wanted. And that also, I think, does something extremely interesting, which fascinates me. It's the change of mentality. If you deal in cash for the first time, if this is something new, think about what you're doing. You're suddenly saying not just that you're going to swap one thing, barter one thing for another in a marketplace. You're saying that you can make an abstraction out of this, not just this pile of pots for this pile of timber, but the value and the price of both of those. You can write it down, you can calculate it, you can play with it in a certain sense. In other words, mathematics comes very early into people's everyday lives. And I have a theory, well, it's in the book all the way through, as you say, that the fact that mathematics suddenly comes into people's lives, that they take this for granted, makes it possible to bring back the great Greek mathematics when the texts like Euclid are rediscovered, and also makes it possible to go forward, because it means that when you look at a phenomenon in the world, as it might be a rainbow, as it might be the colors in a bird's wing, you can look at it with a mathematical point of view, a scientific, an analytic point of view. You can make an abstraction out of it. Theory is born, for better or worse.
Michael, just finally, I wanted to ask you about sort of bringing things right up to date and looking at Europe now, because it's interesting that when we think of European institutions in the contemporary world, it's often about chasing a certain, you know, a cohesiveness, a homogeneity, if you like, that maybe seems, upon reading your book, to be very unnatural. Do you think that when we look at modern Europe, we should actually try and go back to reveling in the energy, the change, how diverse this grouping actually is?
I think you only have to look at the present state of economies across Europe to see that we've got to. And we've got ourselves in a ridiculous situation, which is that we're creating new institutions which are extraordinarily conservative. They're about hanging on to what we've always done. But they're not about the possibility of change. We know our circumstances are changing. We know the world is changing. We know economies are changing and how they work. And yet we hang on to what was there before. If we're going to deal with change, we've got to deal with contrast, we've got to deal with observation, we've got to put up with things clashing. And I think the only way we can do that is to stop talking about a Europe modelled after Charlemagne or the Holy Roman Empire with tremendous central institutions, more or less effective, usually less effective in our history. But we should be thinking rather more about what happens on the edges, because it's on the edges that there is a possibility of change, of new ideas, of good ideas. Some of those ideas will, of course, be clashes, and God forbid there should again be war, but it's the necessary friction that produces the energy that sometimes it does seem our Europe is lacking.
Michael, let me just ask you about the writerly approach to this book, because I think it'll strike a lot of readers when they read it if they were expecting an orthodox history, that it's rather different. And the structure is a bit more shifting. It's a bit more creative. It has an almost, I suppose, more of almost like a filmic quality to it. Is that something you're very aware of, or is that just a direction that your kind of work leads you in?
I think it's how I write, for better or worse. I'm always being accused of being cinematic. But I think the point is that it is genuinely difficult to get over subjects like this and keep people interested. If you become too rigorously analytic, you lose readers. And I think these subjects are too important to be lost. I think we need to know about these kinds of things and how things were. So, yeah, why not do it in a film way? I mean, I don't actually think it is a film way, but I think it's a using narrative, using stories, and also changing points of view so that you can actually have a long shot of a period, and you can also go in for an intimate close-up a minute or two later. It may have something to do with cinema. I've written about cinema. I adore cinema. But I think it's also a legitimate way of writing a novel, of writing a story. And history is one more story.
It is indeed, and it's told quite beautifully in the book The Edge of the World, How the North Sea Made Us Who We Are. The author is Michael Pye, and it's published by Penguin Viking. Michael, thanks very much indeed for joining us here on Monocle 24.
Well, that's all for edition 282 of the Monocle Weekly. How is it for you, Tom?
Very good. I've got a lot of excellent ideas for future resignation letters that I may or may not be drafting.
I don't think you need to do it just yet.
Okay, I'll hang on.
You got away with it for another week.
But good, that was good entertaining stuff, is it? Nothing like a sort of incendiary farewell missive.
And also amazing that somebody just 28 years old, Egon Schiele, did so many amazing images and paintings that obviously are with us today. And there's a kind of strange, you know, echo also. You kind of think it was like the Ebola of his time in a strange way, that flu epidemic that, you know, killed his wife and who was about to have a child. And then he dies just 3 days later in this huge kind of pandemic sweeping Europe. 200,000 people die over those winters. It's amazing.
It's actually extraordinary. And I think what is great about it is you think of the, you know, the creative expressions that maybe you're denied losing a great artist at such a tender age. And yet, kind of as Barnaby was alluding to, you know, there is an indelible mark. There is something enduring. And if anything, how contemporary a lot of the nudes in this exhibition at the Court are, they look like modern pieces. And that's pretty extraordinary. What? Over a century later in some cases.
And how amazing that the North Sea is the place for, you know, the home of everything we believe in. You thought it was maybe Naples or Venice. It's actually Grimsby.
Don't knock Grimsby. And it's the home of fish as well. Well, that I think is just about all that we have time for, isn't it, Andrew, on this week's edition of the Monocle
Let's
Weekly.
Do some thanks.
We should. Our producer, Alice Block, and to our studio manager also, Nathan Cooper. Thank you very much. The Weekly will be back at the same time. I don't know, maybe me and you in the chairs. I think Robert Band will still be at large.
I think I'm going to be here next week.
Great stuff. Well, it'll be me and Andrew Tuck in the chairs next week. So do tune in. As always, that Sunday, you can catch up with past editions, of course, on our website via iTunes or SoundCloud. But from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye.